Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hello and welcome to the Indie Football Podcast. The games don't stop, the talking points rack up, and we're here to get stuck into them. I'm your host, Melissa Reddy, and taking on the major themes are Chief Football Writer of The Independent, Miguel Delaney, and our Northern Football Correspondent, Mark Critchley. Guys, let's start off away from the pitch first with what has been described as a major global scandal. Now, Critch, you've been involved in the latest press conferences and such, and I know it's a mind-bending situation. But can you try and summarize what the state of play is with Wigan and how we've got to this point?
Yeah, I think mind-bending just about does it. There's so many different angles and so many different kind of facets to this story that I think it's going to be impossible to cover them all in this podcast. But I think it's safe to say that once everything's said and done, whenever that may be, this has the potential to be just the most kind of baffling incident of kind of football, like English football and capitalism crashing together, and like we've seen with Bolton and Bury before, but this one just takes on a whole new world of weird. So I suppose if we start off, everybody will be familiar with Wigan being previously owned by the Whelan family, kind of a local family done good, if you like, that old kind of model that you think of Jack Walker at Blackburn and similar kind of beneficiaries at you know, kind of in post-industrial towns, if you like. They sold to a company called the International Entertainment Corporation. It's a Hong Kong-based company. And their chairman is a guy called Stanley Choi, who then became the owner of Wigan. And the other thing we know about Stanley Choi is that he's also a high-stakes poker player. And IEC, International Entertainment Corporation, their line of business is generally hotel, casinos, operations in the Philippines, in fact. And so he owns Wigan for about two and a half years, and then the club changes hands in May of this year, just recently. They sell to another Hong Kong company called the Next Leader Fund, and they're led by this mysterious figure called Ao Yung Wei Kai. He buys them for about 17.5 million, and the former owners, IEC, Stanley Choi, they also declare that the same day that they've paid off a 24.6 million pound loan to the club. That has been returned to them. So effectively, this new owner, the Next Leader Fund, has paid about £40 million to take over Wigan. Despite that fact, a few days later, or a few weeks, in fact, the club goes into administration because they decide that they can no longer run it to any kind of financial success. And their reasoning for that is coronavirus, the pandemic, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, there's kind of two main players here in this weird story. There's Stanley Choi, who we know about, this business owner, and then there's Ao Yung, and we know very little about him. Even the administrators yesterday in the press conference, they said that all they know about his history and his like kind of business background is just hearsay at the moment. In the document relating to Next Leader Fund's takeover, there was a line in there that said that Ao Yung has relevant experience in business operations, and that was about it, which is always good to know that you have relevant experience, but it's not exactly the most detailed information that supporters of Wigan want to know. And I think there's another line in there about how he was operating an amateur football team in Hong Kong for 15 years and he won awards for it. Now, there's no kind of public record that I can find so far of this brilliant career that he's had in Hong Kong football. I am trying to talk to people to find out more about it, but he's just a very mysterious figure. And I suppose there's two questions ultimately. You know, for IEC and Stanley Choi, it's how have they managed to buy a business 2 years ago, run it at a loss, sell it during a global pandemic, and then also make a profit on it and then get paid back on a £24 million loan? And then for Ao Yung, it's why would you ever do that deal? Why would you ever buy the club in the middle of a global pandemic and then only days later decide that you can't fund it? And there's loads, I'm sure people will know that there's loads of theories, loads of rumours. People have seen the video with Rick Parry last week. And I suppose, you know, we want to be cautious. We don't want to get too deep into that, anything that's unconfirmed. But that's all part of an investigation that, you know, one day, hopefully, we'll see the fruits of that investigation and we'll know exactly what went on. And the other thing is, at the same time, there's a club to be saved. You know, Wigan have been given a 12-point deduction for entering administration, suspended. It could ultimately be the difference between them being relegated. There's been 75 members of staff who've been made redundant this week. There is, like, some good news. There is some hope that there's been a lot of interest. There's about 50 buyers. Three parties have given proof of funds. So the administrators hope that there's a way out there. The owner of Wigan Warriors has come forward and said that he's interested in making a bid, and then the club would be locally owned and, you know, part of the same stable as the rugby league team. And they're two, you know, they're the lifeblood of the town, those two clubs. But it's just an uncertain time. And, you know, I suppose, yet again, it's this corner of the country, the Northwest, and specifically kind of Greater Manchester and Lancashire, where you have these huge clubs like Manchester United, City, and Liverpool not far away either. But then you've got all these other clubs like Bolton, like Bury, and now like Wigan, the third club of those three. All three of the last clubs to go into administration in English football are from this region. You know, you've got those massive clubs, but then you've also got these smaller clubs and groups of supporters and communities that are concerned that they're going to lose a cornerstone of that community, and it would just be another tragedy.
Miguel, this all raises the wider point of good governance and having more robust checks in place. As Critch has summarised there, there's so many unanswered questions. And how does a club like Wigan get to the point where no one really knows who the owner is, what his actual background is? There's no proper history into it. And the fact that he can put a club into administration so quickly after taking it, buying it at a profit during a global pandemic, there's just too many things up in the air for there not to be question marks over how this has all been able to take place.
Yeah, Critch alluded to it there with some of the comments in the press conference yesterday, where it is genuinely, I mean, I shouldn't really be laughing, but it's almost the absurdity of it, that we can have a situation where they're talking about not knowing much about the owners. I mean, even that prospect alone is incredible, because it's something we've touched on a lot in the Independent. But ultimately, clubs are, as Critch alluded to, they're social institutions, and that warrants a greater level of protection than businesses, because they are different to businesses. Even if obviously a huge pillar of football is, you know, where they have to be run in purely business entities, but they're more than that. And they warrant more protection. And although a bit like with Bury, although the Wigan case is a very specific problem related to the ownership, I think even that, and the fact clubs like this are susceptible to these situations, is part of a wider structural issue in English football, which is basically caused by a massive, massive a financial ladder with huge gaps in it, gaps that are really almost tank traps that clubs keep falling into because of the massive stretch created by the huge money at the top. And the top of the game sucks in everything. It sucks in all interest, which means it sucks in all money, which creates this cycle which perpetually strengthens the top and leaves everyone else caught adrift. And it does get into these kind of desperate situations then where, you know, we have had owners of various profiles, but I think, and even though those are very specific problems, these situations, they're all connected to this wider issue. And you know, we did a big piece in this in February, in May last year, but it's evidence of a pyramid that's no longer really working in the way it should and requires urgent reform. And, you know, I think it's indicative that discussions like this at Wigan, again, even though the actual Wigan case is so absurd in its own right, and there's been so many questions and a big investigation, but it keeps coming back around to the same topics. And one of those being the coronavirus crisis was supposed to offer an opportunity for, the word that kept being used was a reset, and maybe a deep look at how football could assess itself and the direction it was going. And instead, I mean, we're not even out of the crisis, And we have this bizarre situation and sad situation with, you know, a proud local club.
That's exactly it. And there'll be a lot of questions over governance that emerges from this. Like you said, there was always talk around a reset, but perhaps this, as you say, absurd scenario will actually force that into light, because it seemed over the last few weeks that the norm was just going to continue, where the rich get rich, the poorer get poorer, and whoever, you know, whatever clubs go defunct or whatever, it doesn't matter as long as the top of the game is still thriving. Perhaps this situation will actually concentrate the powers that be on finding plausible solutions. But we can talk about that all day. Let's move on to the technical areas. If teams are a reflection of their managers, what are we to deduce from a few of them? Miguel, you've been receiving a lot of heat for your take on Carlo Ancelotti. Perhaps people don't get your point on him. Can you explain what your thinking is around Everton's decision to bring in Carlo?
I mean, I wouldn't say concerns, but my issues with Carlo Ancelotti long preceded his appointment at Everton. It's why I didn't think it was the smartest move for Everton to appointment. I felt it was quite a lazy decision. I mean, first of all, whatever you think about Carlo Ancelotti as a manager, his profile of jobs in the last two decades hasn't been the job that's needed at Everton. They kind of need someone to almost re-energize a club, a project builder. And Ancelotti's never been that. He's kind of been a project facilitator. He's come in, you know, ensured that players perform to a certain level at big clubs and gone from there. I mean, there is a degree, and this goes into the second issue about his actual quality, in which he's obviously been a great cup manager, as illustrated by three Champions Leagues. But on a league basis, which is what Everton really need here, and they need to, at the very least, consolidate their place as the seventh wealthiest and biggest club in the country in that regard, although I suppose biggest is a very subjective term in that sense. But Ancelotti's probably underperformed in the league. He's in 20 years, at the wealthiest clubs in pretty much every country he's been in, as Paris Saint-Germain, Real Madrid, Juventus, Milan, Bayern Munich, you know, given where they were at a financial ladder at the time that it took them over, he's only got four league titles, and two of those were gimmies. PSG, after being taken over by Qatar, their first title after that, in a move that distorted both French football and football in general, and then Bayern Munich, when they're on this run, I think it's one area where Jose Mourinho was right, where almost a kit man could win the league in Germany, such were their financial advantages. So it would have been particularly bad to not win there. So, and beyond that, two league titles. In fact, he hasn't even finished in the top two that much. So in terms of his performance in leagues, I think it's severely open to question. Added to that now, in the last few years, he's not really the manager that he was at Milan in the mid-2000s. In fact, I'm doing a piece in this week about the whole idea of whether managers have a shelf life, how long their span is. He's not even really a manager that won the Champions League with Madrid in 2014. If he was still that manager, the brutal reality is he wouldn't be at Everton. Because the status of jobs he's got has gone lower and lower. And, he ended up being kind of trumped out of Napoli in that sense. And now, I did receive a lot of backlash in regards to this. Everton fans saying, you're bitter. A manager of Ancelotti's caliber wants to join us, but that's a problem in itself. Like, I'm not bitter about it. This is about what's best for Everton and as a journalist, how clubs should be run regarding best practice. Everton shouldn't be accepting managers who basically just see them out, who are dropping down to their level as if they're doing these clubs a favour. With the situation Everton are in, where they have six much wealthier clubs ahead of them, and certainly six wealthier clubs in terms of how they can spend that money as regards FFP, they need to basically think in a different way and be ahead of the curve. And to do that, basically, you've got to get the next best thing in management, not the last best thing in management. In that regard as well, I suppose, a project builder. They've almost got to take the Southampton approach. Now, I know a lot of people pointed to how they've already taken a Southampton manager in Ronald Koeman and that didn't work out, but that's not quite what we mean here. I mean, not every Southampton choice will work out, but in general, they've got the right idea, which is about up and coming coaches who have something to offer and have that hunger about them and are ahead of the game and have the latest tactical ideas, because that has changed a lot. Just like I was talking about this to Critch the other day when I showed him I was looking at a clip of the 2000 Club World Cup between Vasco da Gama and Manchester United. And I remember at the time, I was a teenager, I thought this was the highest level of club football possible. Watching it yesterday, it was one of the slowest pieces of football I've seen. And like, but unrecognisable to today's game. And that's just when Ancelotti was coming into his peak. And like, so the game has transformed, probably quicker, at a quicker rate than at any point in history in the last 5 years, given the kind of the evolution of pressing, you know, all the physical demands. So I think if you're a club like Everton, you've got to get a young manager who's on top of all that, that gets ahead of the game. And if that means that for a while you are seen as a stepping stone, so be it, because being a stepping stone can be a stepping stone for a club and get them up to that level. And to return to the Southampton example, you know, they've pulled off two very good ones with Pochettino and now it looks like Ralf Hasenhüttl. I think that's what Everton have got to think like. And none of this is to say Ancelotti will be a complete failure or anything like that, but I'd be very surprised if he does anything more than a par performance, which is kind of maybe hovering around 7th to 9th. Maybe that's what Everton need for the time being. But in terms of the potential of that club and really maximising it, I don't think Ancelotti is it. And I don't think Ancelotti is anywhere close to his peak anymore. I think he's a manager on the decline.
I take your point there about not going for the last best, but looking for the next best. He has tactically, especially off the ball, made them a better side. Whether that's enough long term, we'll see. But then moving on to Tottenham and Jose Mourinho. Critch, having covered Jose's spell at Manchester United, when you look at Tottenham now, do you see shades of that very same sort of fade and toxicity at just repeating itself?
It's definitely hard not to. I suppose the only difference is that it's almost accelerated. It feels like it's being condensed into like a television series short or something. I don't know. Like, it just feels like everything has been condensed into this like hypo turbo Jose Mourinho. Forget the third season rule. We're just going to do it in 6 months.
He's taken that Amazon documentary to heart.
That's it. Yeah, exactly. That's it. And, you know, fair play to him. He's a true showman in that respect. I thought it was kind of strange the other night that even though they won, it was a dreadful game. All the talk afterwards was about, you know, just where Tottenham are heading under Mourinho. And those questions are inevitable when you watch them because they just don't feel like the dynamic side that we associated under Pochettino. And I think, you know, people are starting to ask very fair and legitimate questions about Levy's decision back in November when he decided to appoint him. I think, there's a debate over whether you make a change now or whether that's ultimately too expensive. What I would question is, how much is it going to cost you in the long run to have Jose Mourinho as your manager? Like, he hasn't really made that much of an imprint on the squad yet, but you imagine that if, for example, the situation with Tanguy and Ndombele accelerates over the next few months and he leaves the club, then that is, I can't remember how much the fee was off the top of my head, but that's a significant amount of money that's suddenly gone down the drain. You then replace him with a player that I would suppose Mourinho likes. And let's face it, his track record in the transfer market isn't great over the last few years. So that's another few million down the drain. And you start to box yourself into a corner where you're basically trapped with this guy. So I do think the questions are legitimate. I do see the same patterns if just accelerated. And I think, a brave chairman or a brave board member or director would look at that and think, maybe we actually made a mistake here and we need to go back on it. Whether Tottenham are going to do that, I have my doubts.
Well, again, it feels exactly like with Everton. It was a vanity appointment. It was a club being seduced by a name who deigned to drop down to their level or what they thought. I mean, that's what it feels like. Because even when Spurs got Pochettino, it was a stepping. You know, he was still a stepping stone manager at that point. Sorry, no, he was an up and coming manager. So it was a kind of promotion for him to get the Spurs job. So in that context, Spurs have never appointed, or not in, in a recent history, and what the modern game is, they've never appointed a manager like Mourinho. And so it does just, and when you consider his career, it is a drop down, but his career is dropping down. And what sums it up, they're playing Arsenal this weekend. I was at the Arsenal match last night. Now, 3 weeks ago, that Arsenal team seemed an unmanageable, chaotic nightmare, as if Arteta was on a hiding to nothing. And yet last night I saw some of the best attacking football I've seen in the Premier League this season. He's fairly quickly figured something out there. There's a lot of holes, and they're possibly susceptible to kind of a classic Mourinho counterattacking game on Sunday. But it was still, you would derive much more optimism and hope and excitement from what Arteta has there at Arsenal to the dreary, tedious football you see at Spurs. So quickly. So I think Critch is completely right that a brave director or chief executive would see what's happening at Spurs right now and think this really isn't worth it. And I mean, and the thing is, I mean, Levy's an executive who's always viewed in the context of it. It's always about the cold hard cash. That's ultimately what it comes down to with him, that he'll take that very academic mathematical decision on what it's worth. Yet the Mourinho decision could be very financially costly for them, especially if they slip away from the Champions League for longer than they need to, because they've appointed a manager who is just past his best. I mean, let's not forget as well, especially in the context of the last week and all the same old rubbish we've heard about mentality. When he got that job, he was telling Levy that barely any surgery was needed. This was a team that, with just a little bit of work, could win a title. Not even, and that's what he told the players as well, not even qualify for the Champions League again. And now, a few months down the line, Mourinho's doing the usual act where the whole world is against him, where he's in this impossible situation where, you know, finishing 14th will be one of the fourth best achievements of his career, whatever. But that's already the language he's using. When by his own admission a few months ago, and especially, I think we were at this game, Critch, were we, when Spurs beat United 3-0 in summer 2018, one of the first games back in 2018-19. Wasn't Mourinho bemoaning that night the quality of the United squad in comparison to basically these hardened winners at Spurs?
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, absolutely.
And now this squad is, you know, it's suddenly got the same problems as the United squad. It's funny that. And, you know, I don't think, even with the squad Spurs have now, I think a good modern manager would get more out of them, much more.
We mentioned Hasenhüttl earlier, Miguel. Do you think that a lot of clubs will be looking at him? I know Southampton have tied him down to a long-term contract, but he does seem the type of manager, if Tottenham or West Ham or any such club that perhaps feel maybe we took the safe hands or the serial winner talk a little bit too far and made a rash decision, is he the guy they'd be looking towards?
If I was Spurs, if I was Everton as well, I'd be going for Hasenhüttl now. I think he should be their next choice, because he's clearly got something about him. And I think this is something that's very important in the modern Premier League, when basically the big six is boxed off, and you could argue even that the top four has been boxed off with how far City and Liverpool are ahead, and now how much wealth Chelsea and United have, even in comparison to Spurs and Arsenal at the moment. But it's important then, I think, if a lot of Premier League clubs are ultimately going to be about just existing and being there, which is a lot of it, and maybe the odd European foray, then I think it's all the more crucial that you have, at the very least, a style of play that is exciting, that makes that fans can identify with, and, you know, makes people want to go watch football. And I think that's what Hasenhüttl has. Because in the City game they're absolutely battered. That was a classic back to the wall. But generally, they play quite exciting, you know, modern, frenetic football.
Speaking of excitement, nothing gets supporters going like big transfer speculation, and the story really of this week, I think of the past few weeks, has been Thiago to Liverpool. Now, the club have knocked down the talk, and while he is world-class, I don't think there's any question marks over his talent, There are a lot of red flags against Liverpool's transfer policy, which is considered the best in the business. Miguel, you interviewed the Bayern midfielder in February. How do you read this situation?
I think it is true, basically, that Thiago wants a new challenge, which is actually a bit interesting time, given that it looks like Bayern are resurgent again. And you could even argue they're maybe the best club in Europe at the moment. But he has been there 7 years now. Actually, as a complete tangent, this is one thing I always think of when I look at the careers of top players who could basically have their choice of anywhere in Europe. I'm always stunned a lot of them stayed so long at one club. I mean, if I was that good a player, I'd be kind of country hopping. I'd be almost doing what Beckham did. Beckham had the perfect career in terms of kind of the cities he got to live in, the cultures he got to sample for a bit. All right, had his kind of his boyhood club at United for a bit, then goes to Madrid, Milan, Paris. You know, that's the way to do it. Whether that imposes on Thiago's thinking, I don't know. But certainly, they want something different. And the impression I get is they've been maybe, I think they might have been given some indication at some point that maybe a Liverpool option was possible and are kind of almost hoping it comes along. But as you wrote in your piece, I think it seems a very slim prospect. Actually, here's one. If COVID hadn't happened, would Liverpool have maybe been more likely to move for Thiago?
It's actually an interesting one because I think COVID probably means that they have to wait to see how the market settles and only make decisions towards the end of it. Now, they'll feel that they're in a luxury position where they don't actually need to do much. So they're not going to start panicking, and waiting doesn't really do them a disservice. If it wasn't for coronavirus, I think Timo Werner happens. But perhaps with still that reduction in the fee, perhaps there would have still been some negotiation around it. The fact that it waited and he wasn't given any indication that Liverpool were going to guarantee him the move put Chelsea in play. So with Thiago, the club have knocked back the talk, but because he's a world-class player, you always have that doubt in your mind of if things, you know, change drastically in the window. For example, if Bayern are willing to reduce the fee by quite a bit still because no one else has come to the table, if he's certain that Anfield is his destination of choice, if there's no better option at the moment and Liverpool think maybe we could get him in for 2 seasons and, you know, get the next best midfielder in the world after that. There's a lot of moving parts, but I think Liverpool will be comfortable in waiting to decide how those parts will fall. Critch, United have been brought up as a new link for Thiago, and that was interesting to me, because it feels like both him and Bayern are trying to do as much shopping as possible to suit them and to benefit them. Can you see United making a move for him, given how well things are working for them in terms of their offence and midfield?
I would personally be very surprised if he ended up at Old Trafford. I think, you know, you've seen that Solskjaer's made quite a lot of progress recently, not only sorting out his first choice starting 11, but also sorting out his first choice midfield. You've seen Pogba and Fernandes come together, even though there was a lot of doubts about whether they could play together. I think it's been proven that they are capable of it. Pogba's a little bit more comfortable doing the things that go unnoticed, shall we say, the slight passes, you know, through balls, stuff like that. Whereas Fernandes is more of an all-action player. And if anything, what they need alongside them is a kind of defensive foil. They might have that in Matic. He signed a new contract. You have Scott McTominay and Fred looking for a place as well, and they were performing pretty well before this new makeup came into the midfield. And so you don't really think there's any reason for them to go for Thiago. I know his ability in possession means that it's also a defensive skill as well. It keeps the ball from the opposition and allows you to protect leads, but I don't think that's what they're looking for. So I would be surprised if they ended up going in for him.
Let's switch things up and assess the gloriously tight chase for a Champions League place. Miguel, Chelsea, an important result against Crystal Palace, but having been so comfortable in a game against a side with nothing really left to play for, there's big question marks over their game management and defensive solidity again.
Kind of sums up Chelsea's whole season in that sense, in that you feel they'll probably get the job done as regards the Champions League, but that they should also be much more comfortable than they are, and almost through kind of a series about structural issues and individual issues that are kind of a consequence of the structural issues, they're not that secure, and they're always in danger. I think some of that is an extension of Lampard's management and the fact that he himself, like for all the talk about the brief careers of the young talent so far, some of their playing careers are actually longer than Lampard's managerial career. So I think he has a fair few flaws in his approach to iron out himself, not least as regards the defensive side in his game. And that is manifesting in some of these results. But on the whole, I think he'll probably just about succeed this season and carry them through. But yeah, they're not always that convincing. And that does apply to the attack as well, in which sometimes, if you, like in contrast to, say, I suppose, like the Guardiola sides that Lampard probably does idealise, they're not completely cohesive yet. They're still a bit reliant on individual input, which is why maybe Pulisic as well has come to the fore and why he's been so influential. Because when they're struggling, it almost feels like he just bursts forward.
There's a lot of excitement around Chelsea. You mentioned Pulisic there and the fact that they're adding to this offense and people keep talking about them as potential title challenges and stuff. But that feels so undercooked because can you really be considered as such when you've got Kepa in goal, when you are making so many defensive mistakes and when you do not have game management, but any sort of protection for that offence that you're building?
Yeah, I mean, Kepa's obviously an issue. I think in an ideal world, Lampard would get rid of him, maybe bring in Onana from Ajax. But it's not an ideal world because they've spent so much on Kepa, which makes him very difficult to offload. Now, to be fair, I think he made a brilliant save in the Crystal Palace game, which proved crucial. And he does have qualities, Kepa. So I think some of his situation is circumstantial. Although you would question his domination of the box. And of course, he's in a very susceptible defence. I mean, it does feel a little bit as if Lampard is going to have these structural issues, he could do with a Van Dijk figure in the back line, someone that kind of just pins so many holes at once. Kante used to do that, but there's obviously all sorts of questions about his best role in this team. And Jorginho coming in yesterday provided another factor. And it's quite weird, even though Lampard has broadly done well, the very fact there are all these flaws points out he doesn't quite know what his best team is yet.
Thanks, guys. After the break, we'll delve into the happenings of the Manchester clubs and assess the relegation battle as well.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Let's get straight into Manchester United. Critch, Bruno has been transformative. You've got Mason Greenwood producing the kind of displays everyone associated with the club knew he was capable of. The attacking weaponry looks excellent, but is it masking a lot of weaknesses still, especially the rear guard?
I'd agree with that on the basis of Saturday completely. I think, you know, that 5-2 against Bournemouth, you saw the Stanislas goal. It's a bit of a calamity. And it was also kind of noticeable that it was the same two players who got picked out by Roy Keane in the Tottenham game, De Gea and Maguire, who were kind of at fault there. And they're two players who are making errors every now and again, and it is starting to get a bit of attention, especially in De Gea's case. You know, there's been so much talk this season about Dean Henderson's form at Sheffield United and basically a lot of questions over the past 2 years over whether De Gea is still at that level. So, you know, there are some slight concerns, but to be honest, I think you know, talk about the defense, the attack masking the defense. I think, if anything, the reverse was true before this little run of form that United have gone on. And generally, the defense has been quite a positive thing for them this season. I think it's like, in terms of goals conceded, I think it's the fourth best in the league. And I think if you look at XG and stuff like that, it's even better than that, perhaps second best. And it felt like, even when results were going against them back in the autumn, and, you know, the pressure was really telling on Solskjaer, they weren't ever really losing games by 2 or 3, or there wasn't an all-around like kind of collapse in the team. He was trying to build from the back and lay those foundations, and you could see them there in the points that they were picking up. The problem was that they were too safe in possession, and they were too just kind of one-dimensional going forward, and that's completely changed now that Bruno's come in. So I think, you know, while you would like to iron out some of the creases that you've seen, especially like last Saturday, I am fairly confident in the defence going forward. And I don't know if it's the area that you'd especially pick out as needing to improve upon. I think, you know, United's priority this summer, from everything I've heard, is still going to be that kind of right-sided forward that they've lacked for a long time now. And obviously Jadon Sancho is the number one target in that respect. So, you know, I don't think it's a barrier for them to achieve the goals of like Champions League qualification and becoming a regular top four side again. But, you know, perhaps if they want to push for a real challenge, which is what people are starting to talk about now, given the form, perhaps it does need a little bit of improvement.
Miguel, what do you rate they would need to be properly established again as Champions League regulars and a title contender?
Mauricio Pochettino. I think they need that to be champions. I mean, I'm still a little bit unsure of this run, because United have been through a few of these runs over the past few years, and there's been a lot of excitement about them. Now, the dimensions of each of these runs has been different, but they've been kind of unsustainable, and I still have questions about Solskjaer in that regard. While I think there's enough about him, and the club has enough talent and obviously enough wealth to be a regular Champions League side again, because I do think at the moment there is just with the way things are kind of playing out, there is a potential for almost a three-tiered top six, which is City, Liverpool, then Chelsea United, then Arsenal, Spurs. So I think while Solskjaer is fine for that, I can't see a world where anyone other than Klopp or Pep Guardiola win the Premier League while those two are in it. I think they're so far ahead of the other managers in it. Certainly those managers at clubs of similar dimensions. I think if United want to be champions again, I think they've got to go for Pochettino. I don't think Solskjaer has enough to win a title with that team. He has probably got enough to be a regular Champions League qualifier. Whether it's enough for an outright title challenge, I suppose this is the question. And this is where the bigger questions come in about this run, and whether it's a mirage or it's actually the foundation of something sustainable. My suspicion in all of this is that it's basically a case of being able to buy Bruno Fernandes and then having two extremely talented midfielders impose a more creative style in this game, or style in this team, rather than anything deeper. Although you could argue, to be fair, that Solskjaer has managed around the fringes not well. What does seem to be a strength of Solskjaer is that he seems to be quite a good psychological manager. Really a little bit like Zidane in that sense, and the players all like him, and he seems to keep everyone quite content. And I suppose you can particularly see that with the attackers and the former Martial, how Rashford's been. And he could well be the perfect type of manager for someone like Greenwood, especially because you're not going to get a better finishing coach than Solskjaer.
Okay, Jamie Vardy is back amongst the goals for Leicester. That was their major problem for a while. Wolves were beaten by Arsenal to lose ground in the top four contest. Setting aside that City UEFA ban decision, which would end up being significant for the team that ended fifth, who do you guys feel takes third and fourth spot come the end of the season?
Do you want to go first, Chris?
Okay. Setting aside the City ban, because I would like to factor that in, because I think they probably will get banned and it'll be three rather than two. But I think it'll be, in that case, Chelsea and Manchester United. I think Leicester are kind of crawling towards the line, and ultimately they're not going to get there, I think. I think United's fixtures, especially between now and the end of the season, are very favourable towards them. And Chelsea just have a little bit more, I think. So I think it'd be those two.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think it'd be Chelsea United 3 and 4. I think Vardy's equaliser against Arsenal was crucial. Had he not got that, I'd have said Arsenal would overtake them, given the trajectories and given the games left. But I think that's just enough to keep Leicester in fifth, which I agree with Critch, I think could be enough to get them in the Champions League, because I think Chelsea or City will at least have a one-season ban upheld, if not a two-season ban.
Miguel, do you think that they would find a rebuild, which is already going to be quite difficult if the ban is not upheld? It's just going to complicate matters further for them. Guardiola has already said he doesn't have the answers for what's gone wrong.
Well, Guardiola's positioned himself quite interestingly, even in that throughout all of this, his line has been, I trust what the club has told me. So that actually, if the worst comes to the worst for City, that actually gives Guardiola an out as regards his career. And there's been a sense of kind of ticking along, and there's been a lot of stories in the background about City setting up contingency plans for what happened in the Champions League. But the kind of the impression, especially when you hear talk kind of them going for Koulibaly, is that it's going to be business as usual to a certain degree. But I don't think we can overstate the how crucial this could be to the future of the club. If it's 2 years out of the Champions League, not only will that affect, A, their financial potential, because suddenly it's all that Champions League money being denied to them, and that at a time when this very FFP ruling prevents them kind of putting more money in, of course, you know, with that wider issue. They're added to that, so they're not going to be able to strengthen the club. You'll have existing players who will want to be in the Champions League, perhaps agitating for moves. Then there's been all this question about whether they can investigate their contracts if they're not in the Champions League because they've had a ban. And then, of course, they'd struggle to have the financial clout to even replace those players. And, you know, it could have a butterfly effect for the club, at least in the medium-term future. And I think it's why this is so huge. And for all I said a few minutes ago about Liverpool and City potentially being the top-tier big two, that's all dependent on Pep staying in his team. And maybe this Champions League ban being upheld.
Might end up that Mauricio Pochettino actually goes there, but at the opposite end of the table, relegation, Norwich look done and dusted. Who are we expecting to join them? Bournemouth have to take something against Tottenham to have any hope of staying in the division with West Ham away to Norwich. Can Aston Villa get something against United? Who are we going for, guys? Who's getting the
best? I think last week I said it would be the three that are currently in the positions, and I really was not prepared for that answer. I didn't realise we were going to answer that question, and I just listed off the three that were in the bottom and justified it by saying I had a £10 bet on Bournemouth. But I think, genuinely, I was proven correct, because it's looking pretty bleak for all three of them down there at the moment. I think my logic for picking Bournemouth even a few months ago was that their running is just horrible. Like, they've got Tottenham up next, and then it's Leicester. I think it's City away after that, Southampton at home, and Southampton travel very well as well on the road, and then Everton away. And the thing with Bournemouth is that historically and over the last few seasons, it feels like they've always had a knack of picking up points against the teams that are around them, and that kind of allowed them to sacrifice games against Big Six teams, when this season they've not held up that first part of the bargain. So it's kind of left them with no room to go. And, you know, I think it looks particularly bleak for them. I think Villa could perhaps climb out of it, because there's still a chance that they could pick up a few points in some of the more favourable fixtures that they've got. And Watford, I think, are playing Man City as well. And Arsenal, I think they go away to the Emirates on the last day. So those final two fixtures for Watford could be crucial. But it really is difficult, because there's the 4-point gap between the bottom three and just above 17th and 16th. And really, 4 points at that end of division, it's kind of a huge total, because, you know, it's a win and a draw, and teams at that end of the league, they get beat a lot. It sounds simple to say, but it's just true. You know, the mathematics don't really work out. So if you've got that cushion, you can be fairly confident. And I wouldn't be surprised if we don't see a change of identity of those teams in the bottom three between now and the end of July.
Migs, you don't want to chuck in your prediction?
Oh, sorry, I said it, didn't I? I think it'll be Bournemouth and Villa to go down with Norwich. I think they're being cut adrift. Also, the fact the way Watford, I mean, it's such a bad race in terms of quality and in terms of results that the pure fact that both West Ham and Watford have won one game each in the last week and since the restart is probably sufficient now to keep them up.
That's all, folks. Thanks for tuning in, and thanks to Miguel and Critch for the expertise. If you're a new listener to the pod, please do subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever you listen. Thanks for tuning in. Goodbye.